Okay. My name is Molly Marin. I am the webinar coordinator for the New York State RTI Technical Assistance Center. Just a reminder that all upcoming professional development offerings are listed on our webpage at nysrti.org. A copy of today's PowerPoint as well as two handouts are available on our webpage. I actually put the link in the chat because with our new facelift on our webpage, the links are a little bit longer. So you can just grab that link if you want. If you haven't grabbed the handouts or the PowerPoint, it's there for you. During today's presentation, please use the chat box for any questions or comments that you may have. And at the end of today's presentation, we'll post a link to a very brief evaluation. You'll also get that via email after the webinar. If you could please take a few minutes to complete that, we do appreciate the feedback. We are very pleased to have Dr. George Bash with us today to present our first webinar in our Strand 16 Response to Intervention, a Multi-Tiered System of Supports series. Today's topic is using key components of a MTSS framework. Dr. George Bash is a professor and director of the Institute for School Reform at the University of South Florida and director of the Florida Statewide Problem Solving and RTI Project for the Florida Department of Education. And at this time, it is my pleasure to welcome with us Dr. George Bash.
Hey, greetings, everyone. Molly and I were just talking a little bit about the weather. I understand it's a little bit starting to get a little bit chilly up there, but as I'm sitting here in Tampa, Florida, it's 90 degrees, so I don't know if that's good or bad or what have you. So I'm pleased to be with you today, and I'll try to answer your questions if you put them in the chat box. I'll try to answer them as we go along. I won't say who asked the question, but I'll repeat the question, and if I can answer it at that time, I definitely will. So you have a few things today to help us with this first webinar. One is the PowerPoint, which Molly already told you how you can download it, and you have a couple of other items as well. You have a single sheet that has a triangle on it with parts of the triangle in green, yellow, and red, and if you can download that and take a look at it, that would be helpful because I'm going to ask you to do an activity. The other thing you have is a handout that is called MTSS Q&A, and that is a resource for you. Throughout these webinars, we're going to be referring to stuff in there, and it's a good backup so that if we talk about today, like Tier 1, what is Tier 1? What are the specifics about Tier 1? How does it differ from Tier 2, Tier 3, that type of stuff? That document really has a much more in-depth conversation about that, about all the aspects of MTSS. Also, a couple of times this afternoon, we're going to stop and take a poll. I'm going to ask you to have reflect on a question and provide your feedback. You may be watching this by yourself, or you may be in a room with a group of people. If you only have one computer in that room, and Molly, confirm here, I think if there's one computer, they can only take the poll once, right? Yes, Molly said yes on the chat. Great. So one of the things I've asked Molly to do before we get started with the content is kind of a getting acquaintance. I'd like to know, not by name necessarily, but I'd like to know what you do in the school district or the district that you work in. So what has appeared on your computer is a poll. You know how to do those polls. So if you'll just take a second and fill it in, I would appreciate it. Well, it looks like it looks like we have 7 responses. I don't know how many people that would be. There's supposed to be about 24 signed up for the webinar today. So it could be, once again, that you're in a room with more than one person. But I'm really glad to see the distribution of people that are participating. We have, obviously, classroom teacher, literacy coach, principal, district person, special educator, school psychologist. So I'm not sure what the other is. If you wanted to type that in there, that's fine. If not, it's okay. I'm really glad to have this variety, because when you ask questions, you're going to be asking it from a different perspective. And the person who put the other, and sorry we didn't have an option there for this, but it's a math interventionist. That's awesome. That's wonderful. So I'm going to start going through here. These first goals are the goals that are the overall goals for all of the webinars that are going to occur this fall. Some of them we're going to address during today's webinar. Others we will be addressing as we go through the fall semester here. Today we're going to focus on understanding the key components of MTSS and beginning to look at how that's linked with the Common Core Learning Standards, but we're really going to go in greater depth in linking it to the standards as we move forward. We're going to spend quite a bit of time in these webinars talking about how to use database problem solving at the building level, the district level, and the student level. How do we align instruction and intervention with Common Core Learning Standards? For example, with kids with disabilities, one of the big challenges we have is when IEP goals and objectives may be focused on skill deficits and not aligned with the grade level standards. And then what happens is that students with disabilities learn a lot of stuff, but what your state assessments test is aligned with the standards. Those IEPs aren't aligned with standards, then those students are going to do poorly on those high stakes assessments. Something we're going to begin talking about this afternoon and throughout the fall is the integration of academic skills with behavior, student engagement, that type of thing. And we're actually going to hit some of that pretty quickly here today. We're going to talk about how do we ensure in a multi-tiered system of supports that we are addressing the needs of English language learners, students with disabilities who are in special ed, and students with disabilities who are on 504 accommodations. I hope we have some courageous conversations. Hopefully this will be a safe place for us to talk about a whole variety of things, some of which will be comfortable, and I'm sure some of which will not. And to reflect on what we're doing, celebrate what you're doing, reverberate, and most importantly, breathe. So for today, this session, we're going to focus on the 6 things that are up here. Understanding the fundamentals. How is it different from RTI, or is it? What are the components of MTSS? What does it look like in a building or in a district when it's actually implemented? What are some underlying assumptions that we really have to have a common language, common understanding about? And I'd really like to get your feedback on some of this stuff. And how do we differentiate the tiers? What's the difference between them? I'm going to toss out a teaser here. And that teaser is that at one level, the tiers really don't exist. They're a model, and they're going to look different in every building, and we'll find out why as we go through this afternoon. But I want you to be fired up for this webinar. I know it's the end of the day. It's the end of my day too. Or getting toward the end of the day. I'm in my office at the University of South Florida, so I can't be having a glass of wine or something while I'm doing this. But if you're at home or someplace where nobody's watching, you could also be having a relaxing beverage or enjoying yourself. So I'm going to show you a quick webinar about getting fired up, and Molly is going to pull this in here. So you may have to expand your screen, or it's here. So Molly, go ahead.
I will play it in just 1 second. Dr. Bash, I forgot to mention the speaker, the green speaker at the top bar of your computer, you may have to mute. I'm not sure if you're going to have feedback, so I'm just letting you know that, okay?
Yeah, so you want everybody to mute their speaker.
No, just you. Just you, if you hear feedback. Okay, everyone, we're going to start this in a second here.
Okay, well, I've asked you to get fired up, and you have no idea what you're fired up about, but hopefully it got your blood flowing just a little bit. So one of the things, before we actually get started here, I just want to mention a couple of things. Everything about multi-tiered system of support is common sense. I've been in education for a long time. I've been in the classroom. I've been a school psychologist. I've been a building principal, a district administrator, and now I've been at a university for a while doing what university people do. And we don't want to take common sense out of our daily work. If something doesn't make sense to you, I suggest you don't do it until it does. And I'm going to be very commonsensical with you during our time together. And I'm going to start off with something that makes a lot of sense, and that is every system is perfectly aligned for the results that it gets. Results are not random. If year after year a school is performing very, very well, that's not by accident. That's because that school's processes and structures are perfectly aligned for the results that it gets. The opposite is also true. If year in and year out, a group of kids, the entire school, is not doing well and it's not improving, it's because the system is perfectly aligned to produce poor results. If students with disabilities are not improving, the system is perfectly aligned to keep them there. If the entire school is not doing well, something about that system is working really, really well to ensure that year after year, there are poor outcomes. So if we don't like our outcomes, we have to change some aspects of the system. And that is what MTSS is basically designed to do. This quote by Seymour Saracen, I like it a lot. If you want to change and improve the climate and outcomes of schooling for both students and teachers, there are features of the school culture that have to be changed. And if they're not changed, even your well-intentioned efforts will be defeated. So throughout these webinars, I want you to look at and ask yourself, what makes sense to me? What is something here that I think I could take back and use at a small level or a large level to change something so that the alignment is disrupted if you're not happy with the results that you've been getting? So I always ask two basic questions. Are you happy with your student data? And is every classroom one in which you would put your own flesh and blood? And if the answer to either of those questions is no, then there's work to be done. In all the different schools I've worked in, when I was a building principal doing walkthroughs and providing staff support and creating a culture of safety and honesty and approaching our problems with an open mind, I would look at every classroom that I was in and I'd say, would I put one of my kids in there? Would I be happy with one of my children being in there? More recently, would I be happy with one of my grandchildren being in there? And if we wouldn't put our own kids in there, then we should take the initiative to do something about that. Some fundamental assumptions here. And Molly, if I forget where, because I don't have my whole slide laid out here, if I forget where that next video is going to come in, just give me a prompt. Some fundamental assumptions. There are no quick fixes. Education is a, as we all know, is an entity of fads. Somebody's always bringing something new to you to try to get you to do something different. The problem in education is we keep adding things and we never take stuff away. So there are no quick fixes, and important work is always hard work. There is a need for general, special, and gifted education, but not as it currently exists, because it's not working terribly well. Oops, I'm pressing the wrong button here. Too much time has been spent admiring problems. We have data, we look at the data, we talk about the data, but we often then don't change anything so that the data changes. No student is worthless. Even the worst student is a good example of what is not working. And the students that are experiencing the greatest difficulties often are beacons for us to help us understand what needs to be changed. And the best place to address diverse learning needs is in the instructional process. All of us for years have been attending meetings in school. We attend problem-solving meetings, we attend lesson planning meetings, we attend curriculum meetings, etc. I have never seen a kid improve instructionally, academic or behaviorally, because we're in all those meetings. Where kids improve is where the instructional process and the student meet together. So we're going to talk about some of that. The instructional process, if it's good, it's awesome. If it's not, it's a problem. So if you want to start that, Molly, you could start it. Okay, Molly, you can stop. You can stop it and remove it. That's good. All right, I want to do a gut check on the audience here. Type in what movie you think that clip is from. Awesome. Well, all that, yeah, you're all right. Excellent. Well, I know you're not 20 years old, that's for sure. So I think I can't remember the exact data, but a couple of months ago, it was either the 30th or 40th anniversary of this movie. And as a little piece of trivia, by the way, that Ferris Bueller House in Chicago is one of the most frequently visited tourist attractions for drive-bys. Good. All right, so what we're going to talk about today is a shift in thinking. When we're concerned about students, the central question is not what is it about the student that's causing performance discrepancy, but rather what is it about the interaction of the curriculum, the instruction, the student, and the learning environment that should be altered so that students can learn and will learn. So I have a quick question for you here, and there's going to be a poll pop up here. As you think about how you problem solve or look at student and academic issues in your school, do you routinely consider issues that are related to instruction, curriculum, the environment first rather than the student? And when you're collecting data, do you collect data on all of those areas? Or in where you work, is it primarily looking at giving the student test, diagnosing, thinking what's wrong about the student? So take a look at these, and I'd appreciate it if you would, I think we have two polls ended up popping up here at once. That's okay. Go ahead and fill them out, both of them out. Okay, the poll seems to have settled down a bit here. So I'm glad to see that virtually everybody who responded is at some level of either agreeing about moving toward implementation or is actually doing it. And what doesn't surprise me as well is that the problem-solving process is still focused primarily around the student. So that's good, because we'll have a lot of interesting things to talk about here. Also, I see that somebody indicated that they were 24 and know about Ferris Bueller's Day Off. It's a classic movie. I love it. Thank you for responding. So let's talk a little bit about the difference between RTI and MTSS. I think it's important. For a number of reasons, so we'll just talk about it. RTI, the definition of RTI, the most frequently cited one, is providing high-quality instruction and intervention matched to student needs. We have to figure out what are those student needs, and using learning rate over time and level of performance to make important educational decisions. And the problem-solving process is the process that is used to develop effective instruction and intervention. We'll clarify that a little bit. Now, when RTI first started out, it really was focused on individual students. And the big difference between RTI and MTSS is that RTI was traditionally individual student focused, and MTS is really a much broader focus that we'll talk about. After today's webinar, we're gonna start talking about how to use the problem-solving process to inform instruction, but I wanted to introduce it here, and I'm sure you're already familiar with some of this, if not all of it, to fit RTI in. So the problem-solving process has four steps to it, and for me, you can get real fancy with it here and call it problem identification, analysis, all of that kind of stuff, or you can just ask four simple questions. What do we want students to know, understand, and do? Why aren't they doing it? What are we going to do about it? And did it work? Did it work? That fourth step of the problem-solving process is what RTI is, response to instruction and intervention. The RTI issue is really the fourth step of the problem-solving process. So what's the difference between the two? RTI was a practice. It wasn't a systems approach to improving outcomes for all kids. It was focused on the student level, where MTSS can be the student, the classroom, the grade level, the building, the district. RTI was often led by special ed. MTSS, when it is done, implemented with the greatest success, it's led by general education. RTI was related to interventions and to some degree special ed. MTSS is focused on accelerating the performance of all students. With RTI, we had more rudimentary data systems, and it was focused primarily on literacy, in great part because of reading first and early reading first. MTSS uses broader integrated systems. We're going to talk about some of that today. A good example of that is early warning systems. RTI was basically implemented at the district or school level. There was no broad systemic approach to doing it, where MTSS is often a function of the state education agency providing supports to districts to do that. Something that I'm going to add for the next webinar is, where does MTSS fit in the Every Student Succeeds Act, ESSA? I have something that I have to do toward the end of the week, so I was doing some work on it today, showing specifically where in ESSA MTSS is cited, and more importantly, how do you fund it? Because ESSA provides funding avenues to support the implementation of MTSS. And we'll talk about some of that next time. RTI was purely practice-driven, and now there's a lot of policy stuff, and we're going to talk about some of that policy stuff. So let's look at the definition of MTSS compared to the definition of RTI. MTSS is an evidence-based model of schooling. So I got a question because I'm on the board for the National Center for Learning Disabilities, and I got a question. We get questions sent to NCLD, and then they're farmed out to the board members. And so I got a question last week that asked, how do you provide grades for RTI? How do you add RTI to the report card? Do you have an RTI grade? And are there RTI tests? MTSS and RTI is a model of schooling that uses data-based problem solving to integrate academic and behavioral instruction. Sorry, I didn't turn off my email and it popped up. Integrating academic and behavioral instruction and intervention. The tiers are simply, how do we intensify instruction and interventions? And we're going to talk about that today. Before we leave today, you will know how we intensify across the tiers. And MTSS is need-driven. In many of our schools here in Florida, schools are given MTSS support based upon two things. One, student outcome data for the school, and two, their level of implementation of MTSS. We have a statewide, and I'll share it with you at some point at one of these webinars, we have a statewide progress monitoring tool that is evidence-based for assessing school-level implementation of MTSS. And it's a formative assessment process. So we can assess how well a school, how much and how well a school is implemented. And we give supports to school differentially. And the goal here is to accelerate the performance of all students. We never talk about closing the gap. Closing a gap is really related to the lower performing students, catching up to either proficiency or standards or other students. If we accelerate the performance of all students, the gap for students who are below proficiency or standards will automatically be closed. But we will also be recognizing the needs to accelerate students who are above standards level. So you won't hear anything about closing the gap in these webinars, at least not from me. I would like for you to, this video, this is Alexa Posny, who was the previous Assistant Secretary of Education for Special Ed and Rehabilitation Services. She refers to a gentleman named Michael in this, and that's Michael Uden, who is the Assistant Secretary for Elementary and Secondary Education. So if you could just play it real quick, it's a short video. Okay, so the big takeaway here, and this is a belief issue. It's a shift, and I would like you to, between now and our next time together, reflect on this a little bit, because when I was at this meeting this weekend, this issue came up. Special ed kids are general ed kids first. Special ed is a service to general ed. It is not a separate process of education. And one of the reasons why students with disabilities have such low proficiency rates on statewide assessments is because their instruction is not aligned with standards as much as other kids. So one of the big things we're going to talk about in these webinars is how do we ensure that special education instruction integrates general education, pacing charts, scope and sequence, standards alignment, and how do we ensure that instruction in general education integrates those specially designed instruction strategies so that kids with disabilities can do well in that general ed classroom. This tension between general ed and special ed is certainly resolvable. And MTSS is one good way to do that. So we'll talk quite a bit about this. So I want to give you a bottom line, some of this common sense stuff I was talking about before. Whether we use MTSS or anything else, here's our way of work that will accelerate kids. Early warning and identification. Find them before they fail. We have wonderful assessments that can predict that a kid is going to be off track before the kid is ever significantly off track. We never want to wait, ever. If a kid is behind, we act now, we act fast. If we know what to do, we simply do it. If we don't know what to do, we engage the problem solving process. Something that I'm just gonna throw out right now. So if you have a pen or a paper with you, or on your hand, that doesn't matter, just write this down. Write the number 4 down. A kid is in fourth grade. Now write the number 2. The kid is reading at the second grade level. If you subtract 2 from 4, you'll see that that student is 2 years behind. Now, that student has been in school for 4 years, not counting kindergarten. If the student is only at the second grade level in reading, that means that student's rate of growth is a half a year for every year they're in school. So 4 times a half is 2, right? So you could predict if nothing changed and this student grew a half a year each year for the next 4 years, that would be another 2 years, and the student would be at the fourth grade level in the eighth grade. Well, even really good interventions tend not to close a student's gap between their grade level and their performance level by more than about a half a year, sometimes 3/4 of a year, in a year's time. So if in fourth grade, this student stopped getting behind, in other words, we found some way to get the kid moving a year for a year, the kid would still have 2 years to catch up. If they can catch up at a half a year in a year's time, that's 4 years to catch up the 2 years. So to summarize it all, a student who's only behind 2 years in fourth grade, even with outstanding instruction, will have to get to the eighth grade before they ever catch up. Now, they not only have to grow a year for a year like everybody else, they have to catch up a half a year in a year's time. So we're asking them to grow a year and a half, every year for 4 years just to catch up. In other words, the kids who are struggling, we're asking them to outperform the kids who aren't by 50%. That's not going to happen. So the statistics are these. For kids that are 2 years or more behind in fourth grade, there's an 8% chance they will ever catch up. Any distance that a kid is behind, you have to add to a full year's growth because that kid has to catch up. So think about kids like at a track meet, 400 meter run. If you come out of the block slowly, you have to run faster than everybody in front of you to even catch up. So this is serious business, and we never, ever want to wait. We monitor progress to be sure that the instruction and the interventions are working. Progress monitoring is to be sure that we know if something is working. Here's some other statistics for you if you want to write these down. We'll get to these later. There's 330 to 360 minutes in a day, 1,650 minutes in a week, and 56,700 minutes in a year of instruction time. We don't have any more time than that. So if we wait, we can't recoup that time to help a student. And time, as we're going to see shortly, is the best predictor of student growth. We monitor progress. We modify the instruction as necessary. Again, we don't wait. We'll talk about how long do you monitor progress? How long do you wait? How long do you do interventions? How do we make those decisions? And by the time you finish this webinar series, you'll have the answers to those questions. And the other issue is we have to be honest and transparent. I really get sad and frustrated when I'm working in schools where we're trying to problem solve really important issues, and there's a climate where people feel blamed, teachers feel thrown under the bus. Look, this is complex work. It's nobody's fault. There is no one place to blame. You don't blame the home. You don't blame the teacher last year. You don't blame the school that the kid came from. You just forget all that stuff, and you just are honest and transparent about figuring out what the heck we need to do to get these kids back on track. So we're going to talk throughout this webinar series about different components of MTSS. There are six of them. I'm just going to mention them briefly. You have to have leadership in a building and at a district level to make this work. Teachers and others can do a certain level of this work without support, but it won't sustain. Tiers of instruction is basically how we deliver instruction. We're going to talk about that tonight, so we'll just pass on that for now. The problem-solving process, I already showed it to you briefly. It's a standard process we use to analyze, develop, implement, and evaluate academic and behavioral instruction. Data evaluation is what data do we use and how do we use it? Communication and collaboration, that's essential to ensuring that if we have multiple providers of services, a general ed teacher, perhaps an interventionist, a literacy coach or a literacy teacher, a special ed teacher, how do we get all of our instruction aligned? We don't want to ask a kid to remember what happened in a literacy intervention and then have an eight-year-old be responsible for how to figure out how to integrate that into third grade reading language arts. And capacity building. We want our district and our buildings to get better. And the only way we can do that is to get these best practices in the DNA of the building and the district. So we will talk about how to build capacity through this process as well. So very quickly, what does it look like? all instruction and supports are delivered through a multi-tiered system. If it doesn't fit in the triangle, it shouldn't be in the building. We'll talk about why later. Decisions regarding instruction and support are made using data and a problem-solving process when we don't know what to do. So I have some bumper stickers in my life. One is, in God we trust, everyone else brings data. If you're God, you don't need data, just fix it. Otherwise, we need data. What we do know is that when educational decisions are made without data, they have a very high probability of not working. The other bumper sticker is, data will set you free. For my entire career, I've listened to this argument about direct instruction. A whole variety of instructional processes in reading. Everything from constructivist to direct instruction and everywhere in between. And I see adults getting into discussions and arguments over what is the best pedagogy. I see school psychologists getting into arguments over, do we do processing assessment or not? Here's the question that I always ask. Whatever you've been doing, is it working for your students? So if we're taking a whole language approach to reading, and we have a bunch of kids from environmentally challenged backgrounds, and they're not improving, I'm not sure why we keep that approach. So I don't like to get into arguments about philosophy or approaches without looking at the student outcome data and saying, for the approach we've been using, quit trying to defend it. How are the kids doing? All of our problem solving has to consider academic and behavior together. Every academic skill has an academic behavior. We'll talk about that in a moment. And almost all behavior in school is influenced one way or another by academics. We'll talk about that. A district-based team is responsible for monitoring the performance of schools and determining the overall health of the district and providing supports to schools. A school-based team is responsible for monitoring student performance to determine the overall health of the school. So here's how I define health. Let's say that we're looking at student data three times a year, October, January, and April, or let's say at a high school, we're looking at it every 9 weeks when report cards come out. So I'll give an elementary example and a high school example. When we gather in January, are more kids making proficiency or making growth toward proficiency than there were in October? Literally the number. If you're in a school that has 500 kids in elementary school, or 1,000, or welcome to Florida, 1,500, how many are at or above proficiency in October? How many are at each level of risk? If you're using Bibles, if you're using Renaissance Learning, if you're using something else that has red, yellow, blue, green, how many kids are there in each of those categories? And in January, how many kids are in the green and how many kids have jumped a level, even if it's from red to yellow? And if that number is positive, you have a healthy school. If it's negative, it says the longer kids are in this building, the worse off they get. That's an unhealthy school. You shouldn't come to school and have a probability of getting worse. So health can be defined by these numbers. At the high school level, we use things like how many Fs? Ninth grade, how many Fs were given in October, in the first grading period? How many Fs are given in the second grading period? A healthy school has kids moving out of the bottom and toward the top. If the number of Fs is getting worse throughout the year, students are at greater risk for getting an F the longer they're in that building. That's an unhealthy building. So we're going to talk throughout this semester about what data do we use to determine the degree to which that building is a healthy place for kids. Parents are engaged in the problem solving and instruction intervention process. We'll talk about how. Student engagement is a primary priority. How much of the learning is student-led? How do we define student engagement? How do we know if they're engaged? There's a strong relationship between student engagement and student progress and school success. Lesson planning is a hugely important process. We'll discuss that a little later on in the semester. Early warning systems, we'll discuss those, are critical. We can tell you in sixth grade what the probability is at about 82% level whether kids are going to graduate from high school on time. We can tell you with a 50 or 60% confidence at the end of third grade whether that's going to happen. Early warning systems are awesome, and they let us know who's in trouble early on so we have time to change that trajectory. The focus is always on tier one. We'll talk about why and universal design principles, and we'll talk about what those are. The district leadership is held accountable for overall implementation and outcomes in district performance, and building principals are held accountable for the performance of the building that they're in. If a school's health is going downhill, we have to have an accountable officer for that. It's the building principal. I was one for 8 or 9 years, and I understand fully that responsibility. But somebody has to be that ombudsperson. I've already said the different levels of analysis. We can do this at a whole variety of levels. So I want you to look at this slide. You got a whole bunch of kids on the left. You've got three tiers in the middle, and you have a triangle that's all green on the right. If you were to say in a short phrase what this means, what would you say? And if you're comfortable enough, I'd appreciate it if you would put it in the chat box. So blah, blah, blah plus blah, blah, blah equals blah, blah, blah. Yeah, you folks are all hitting about the same stuff. Outstanding. A number of school districts that I work with actually use this graphic. It's posted in every school to reflect both belief system and way of work. High schools, middle schools, elementary schools. The one thing I wanted to point out, just to be sure that is understood, is that the green triangle on the far right doesn't mean that all kids are getting only tier one. And that's the reason why we left those lines in that triangle. Some kids are going to need tier two and tier three for their entire educational career. So what you've said is accurate, is that if we provide effective, appropriate instruction, all kids can succeed. The question is, how do we do that with the resources we have? We're going to constantly this semester be balancing this question of need versus resources. And I love your answers, by the way. Super. So these students get these supports, in order to meet those benchmarks. Awesome. So if somebody catches you in the elevator and says, what is this MTSS junk? I hear it. And you've only got 1 minute between floors or less. What would you say? Maybe you would say this. Good job. So the graphic here is just to show that multi-tiered system of supports and the problem-solving process embedded in it becomes our way of work. So for those of you, it doesn't matter to me whether you're a teacher, a district administrator, a math interventionist, special educator, school psychologist, all the things that you checked. If somebody talks to you about a kid, a group of kids, a grade level, I'm hoping at the end of this semester that in your building, my wish would be that everyone goes to asking four questions, not what are they not doing, not what is the problem. I don't want to know what problems are. The problem is already visible or we wouldn't be talking about it. I simply want to know, what do we want that kid or those kids to be able to do to be successful? Don't worry about anything else. What do we want them to do? So if you have referral forms in your building now that says referral problem, get rid of them. And instead put up there, what do I want the student to know, understand, and do? We'll learn that you could problem solve for a problem. You might stop the problem, but you will never get kids to be successful at what you want them to do. So what do I want the kid or kids to know and understand and do? Why can't they do that? What's up with that? What are we going to do about it? And did it work? And if everybody comes at this from those four questions, then how we view this world of improvement will have common language, common understanding, and a common vision. So lots more about that this semester. Please rate your perception. You already did this one. Let's see, where are we on time? We have a lot more people here. Molly, can we put that up again? Because we didn't have as many people. Very quickly, do this quickly. Do this poll quickly as soon as Molly puts it up here. I want to see your answers again. Okay. It's about the same. I just thought that with more people, it might pop up different. Thanks, Molly. And thank you for being consistent and answering the question the same way two times. All right, let's talk about some of the underlying assumptions. And folks, what's going to be important about some of these is that they're also beliefs. And you might have to have some conversations offline about this, back at your school if you're there with other people. Because they really are fundamental and undergird this way of work. And once again, this is that document that you can download to help you with some of these things. So here's the first one. We look at students, what we're going to focus on in three broad areas: academic skills, academic behaviors, and inter and intrapersonal behaviors. So we'll talk more about these as we go through the semester. I'm going to give you a list of academic behaviors, but let me just give you some brief definitions here. Academic skills are basically what kids have to know and be able to do to attain the Common Core learning standards. So your standards set and define the academic skills section. So every time a student or a group of students we're problem solving for them, what we want to say is, what standard or standards do we want them to attain? Academic behaviors are behaviors that kids need to have in the teaching and learning process to engage it. So, for example, at the one level, listening, following directions, ignoring distractions, self-monitoring, setting a goal. The academic behavior that is least well developed across the age span is asking appropriate questions. When students ask questions, that lets the teacher know what they understand and what they don't understand. If students don't know how to ask questions, they stay silent. If they ask the wrong questions, they convey error to the teacher. So academic behaviors are behaviors that students need to engage instruction. The inter and intrapersonal behaviors are things that distract students from instruction, whether or not they have engagement. Interpersonal are those issues that are internal to the person. Traditionally, those things are like anxiety, depression, ability to concentrate. We'll talk more about that. That's intra. Interpersonal behaviors are behaviors between kids. So supportive behaviors, teasing, off-task behaviors, threatening behaviors, provoking behaviors. And so we'll talk much more about those as we go through. But every time we're talking about a problem that we're going to be focusing on finding solutions for, goals that we set, we're going to say, what are the academic skills that we're focused on? What academic behaviors are involved with those skills? And where do the inter and intrapersonal behaviors play into this? The second principle that undergirds this is standards-aligned instruction. So we don't teach standards, right? We use instructional strategies for kids to have the skills to attain the standards. So this is actually, the one you see in front of you, is a third grade or fourth grade reading comprehension standard. Students should be able to recount stories, including fables, folktales, and myths from diverse cultures, determine the central message, lesson, or moral, and explain how it is conveyed through key details in the text. And you have a student referred because they can't read, or they can't read at grade level. I have no clue what that means. Because in this case, this is what reading means at that grade level. So unless we know what the standard is for the grade level, and we know the rigor of that standard, and the expectations and task demands of that standard, how do we engage in problem solving for something that we don't know what it is? Now, I'm sure all of you are familiar, particularly the classroom teachers, that you unpack standards, and we're going to do some of this, not tonight, but as the webinar progresses. Unpack standards. We either circle or underline verbs, and that's what kids have to do. And we either circle or underline nouns, and that's what they have to know. So we can find out what a kid has to know and do by looking at the nouns and the verbs in standards. So unpacking them for use in a multi-tiered system in problem solving is not difficult. We're going to give you some templates that take that standards to develop academic skills and then fold in student academic behaviors and be able to look at it in an integrated way. Academic engaged time is critical. Academic engaged time predicts student growth better than any other variable. Academic engaged time is very simple. It's the number of minutes a day, a week, and a year that students are engaged in quality instruction. So an example of threats to academic engaged time, absence, chronic absenteeism, tardiness. Another threat to it is what I call the Motel 6 syndrome. Lights on, nobody's home. The kid is there physically, but is not there cognitively or emotionally. So we will talk about how to measure academic engaged time, and we will work with it a lot as we build interventions, and we'll see that shortly. Rate of growth. This is critical. Everything about MTSS is rate of growth, not discrepancy, not how far is the student behind. It's what is the rate of growth necessary to re-engage the standards. So I'm going to ask you to look at a couple of graphs here. These are relatively recent data for those of you who are interested. They are from the assessments for Discovery Math, and these are three assessments. I think it is, there's three assessment windows, and to be honest with you, I can't see my slide here very well, but I think it's basically fall, winter, and spring. So the blue one is the student, and the red one is the classroom the student is in, and the green one is the performance of all the classrooms at this grade level. So rate of growth is the slope of the line, the angle of the line. The steeper the angle, the greater the rate. The lower the angle, the slower the rate. So I want you to look at just the first two data points on this graph, not the last one, just the first two. Who is making the best rate of progress? The student, the classroom the student is in, or the grade level? And type your answer. Who has the steepest line between the first two data points? Student, classroom, or grade level? Absolutely. Who's the farthest behind? The student. The effectiveness of instruction is measured by a student's rate of growth, not how far behind they are. So this student is getting highly effective instruction. Even though the student is far behind. So we would never terminate whatever intervention this kid is getting on the basis of how far behind they are. Any student whose slope of the line is greater than the classroom, that student is growing faster than the rest of the students in the class. In this case, McKinsey is growing faster than the other students in her classroom. Why would we stop an intervention? So rate of growth is going to become paramount. This is with academics. Now let's take a look at that same student, the same classroom, with behavior. So I think that this is on-task behavior, percent of time on task. So the bottom graph is the student. The top graph is the classroom. If we didn't take classroom data as well as student data, we would probably think something was wrong with this student between data point 2 and 3. Student improved really well and then dropped off. But look at the entire class. The entire class fell off, and fell off at a steeper rate than the student did. So whatever happened with this student is a function of what happened in the class, not the student. So the takeaway is here. We never collect data on individual students without also collecting data on other classmates to be sure that a change in an individual student profile is the function of the student and not the classroom. And this semester we're going to learn how to do that if it's something that you don't already know how to do. So when we take a look at the academics, and between data point 2 and 3, the academics start to level off. And we also take a look at the behavior. There might be a relationship between the two here. Hence, student engagement on task and student progress in terms of accuracy and proficiency. This is just another example. I'm not going to go through this one. We can skip that one. So if we take a look at the tiers, let's end. I want to leave a minute or two for questions. I'm going to tease you a little bit with not giving you a lot of information. And we'll pick up here at the next webinar. But I'm going to define the tiers for you very simply. The tiers are defined by who gets the service, academic and or behavioral. That's it. We never define the tier by what the service is or any other factor. So what is tier one? Tier one is what everybody gets. If you're in an alternative school, I was principal of a school where we had an alternative school as part of it, and people thought all those kids were tier three. They weren't. There's stuff that was done academically and behaviorally for all those kids. And there were some kids that got, there are very few kids in that alternative setting that got some services. So tier one is what everybody gets. It is the least amount of time devoted to academic areas. So at high school, if a standard high school, it's 50 minutes per period. If you're blocked, it's 100 minutes. For elementary school, for reading language arts, it's typically 90 minutes. It's the broadest curriculum. At the elementary school, it's all five components of reading: phonics, phonemic awareness, fluency, vocabulary, and comprehension. It's the whole curriculum at the high school for that subject area. And we take the fewest number of assessments. We might simply do benchmark assessment 3 times a year. Or use report card data 4 times a year. So it is what everybody gets. It's the broadest curriculum and the least frequently assessed. For tier two, it's what some kids get. This is typically given in group kind of instruction for kids who have the same needs, academic or behavior. So it might be a group of kids who are focused on fluency. It might be a group of kids in Algebra 1 who are struggling with some type of algorithm. It might be a group of kids getting social skills training. But it's some kids. It's a standard protocol. That group gets the same thing. It's just a smaller group. Now, tier two is always more time. It's in addition to tier one. It can't be instead of. It's got to be in addition, because anytime you reduce academic engaged time for a content area, you're going to reduce a student's rate of growth. So if a kid is getting tier two for reading, they need to be in tier one as well. It's tier one plus tier two. How much more time? The upper limit of tier two is 50% of tier one. So for reading language arts, 90 minutes, tier two would be up to 45 minutes more. It's more frequent assessments. Formative assessments, usually monthly, give or take. We'll talk about the frequency of assessments. It's greater intensity. So let's define intensity. Intensity is more time, in this case, up to 45 minutes, narrower focus of the curriculum. So it might be on fluency or fluency and vocabulary. It's not all on five areas. It might not be on the whole algorithm in algebra, but it'd be on the algorithm that the kid is struggling with, the part of the algorithm the kid is struggling with. And type of instruction. It may be that we have to alter our method of instruction for the kids in tier two. And throughout this semester, we're going to be talking about what that altering looks like. So tier two is some kids. Standard protocol, all those kids get the same intervention, based upon the problem-solving process. It's up to 50% more time. The focus of the instruction is narrowed to the curricular area the student is having problems with, and we assess more frequently. The last area is Tier 3. This is intensive, individualized. Very few kids get this. We're going to break each of these down in the next webinar to get down specifically. But Tier 3 is very unusual. In most cases, most school districts, they don't even give Tier 3 instruction. When we look at the characteristics of Tier 3 instruction, I think you'll admit you're not, for the most part, delivering it. It's the most intensive instruction a building can give. Clearly, how well you can do Tier 2 and Tier 3 is based upon the resources in your building. So Tier 1 is what everybody gets. Tier 3 is the most intensive service you can give a few kids, typically 5 to 6% of your building. And Tier 2 is in the middle. So that's why I say these tiers don't exist, because they're really resource determined and they're building determined. What does everybody get? What do some kids get? What do very few kids get? And when we start aligning resources on how to actually implement this stuff, you will see that it very much is building driven. So I'm going to stop there for tonight. I have about 5 minutes left on my clock. And, you know, what questions do you have? What comments do you have? Okay. Well, I tell you what I'm going to do. I know you have a small evaluation or something to fill out here. I am going to, my email is on the front of this PowerPoint. And it's my last name at usf.edu. And if you have questions that you would like for me to address before the next webinar, email me. And in the subject line, put New York RTI webinar or something. So I'll pay attention to it and see it. Because I'd like to be able to I'd like to be able to be responsive to your questions. I also see that somebody just put, they clicked on the PowerPoint and it's not coming up. Did it download onto your check and see if it downloaded onto your computer. Or Molly, you might have to intervene.
Yeah, Carol, I just put Dr. Bash's email in the chat, or Christine, I think Christine put that in there. But also, if you go to our webpage, where you registered for today's event is also where you'll find the PowerPoint. Any issues, you can always email me as well. And you'll get an email from me shortly with the link to the evaluation, which I've also posted in the chat for you. So hopefully that helps you, Christine. Any questions, just let me know. It looks like Carol has a question too, Dr. Bass.
Where can I find Tier 2 interventions of support? I'm not sure about what the question means. Types of interventions, characteristics of the interventions. Help me out here, Carol. Yes, types of interventions. Are you familiar with What Works Clearinghouse? Okay. Google What Works Clearinghouse, and clearly the type of Tier 2 intervention is going to be a subject of tied to the subject area, the academic area. An example of Tier 2 interventions for behavior, Carol, would be social skills training group, anger control, group, self-control, self-monitoring, self-instructional skills, examples of tier two interventions. And I'll just, since we have 1 minute left, an example of a tier two intervention for reading could range from reteaching a particular instruction for a day to a group of kids who need reteaching. One of the most powerful strategies is to reteach, review, teach, review, reteach cycle. And so some kids who are struggling, if they simply get a second scoop of it, that's going to be enough. For other students, it would have to be evidence-based strategies for some aspect of one of the five big areas of reading. So an example would be the practices in Wilson's Foundations. We don't want tier twos to be programs necessarily, but if a particular program like Wilson's Foundations, if those teaching strategies are what the kids need, then we could use Wilson's Foundation. So here in Florida schools, we have some schools where you have everybody is taught foundational reading stuff and everybody's taught Wilson's Foundations. We do that in a lot of our schools with English language learners. In other schools, they use it for tier two. So we'll throughout this semester, I'll be sure that we get lots of resources around that. And what do you think? That manual is certainly a starting place, the PRIM manual. What I'm going to share with you is what I want you to come to consensus for yourself or your group. What are the characteristics of Tier 2 instruction? Not what programs are there. So once you know the characteristics of what Tier 2 looks like or should look like, you can then select strategies or programs that match those characteristics. So we'll spend some time about that next time. Yeah. The comment about the peers, absolutely. You always think that somebody's different, below proficiency, weird, whatever you want to say, until you hang out with their peers, and then you find out how many times have you done an observation where a teacher said they're really concerned about that student. You then go into that classroom, and it appears as if that student is the least of your worries. You find a lot of other students that seem to be having many more issues than that student. So when we're looking at this multi-tiered system of supports, we always have to have the students we're concerned about as well as the group that they represent, and we're going to learn how to do that very specifically this semester. Okay, I don't want to take any more time because I want to promise that we'll be done on time, and I really appreciate the fact that you signed up for this, and I hope it's worth your while. At any point, if it's not, you need to let me know. Thanks a lot. Good night, folks.
Thank you so much, Dr. Bash, and we look forward to the next webinar. I think it's 2 weeks from today, right?
Okay. Sounds great.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you.
Good night.